This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for the Matt McNeil Show again. I think the only pre-recorded parts of the show are going to be the music. So,
we're playing that live.
Oh, well, some of it, yeah, you and I. So some of the music is live.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we play it.
Yeah.
We're talented.
Yeah, we didn't do that last song, but we're going to be performing some stuff.
You said like the simplest one was the one we weren't playing, so you kind of raised the bar for us here.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know. Otherwise, I look like an idiot because we would have just, you know, I just said that and the song just ended. Anyway, Brett Johnson here with you as well, producing, running the board today, and getting me in trouble already. I know everybody is kind of all excited about this Rolling Stone article and the two insurrectionists naming a bunch of elected officials, and that's a good development. And I think, you know, people are starting to talk about that Merrick Garland should have a special investigator. I'm going to touch on that a little bit. But there are other things that I'm excited about. There's been some progress made in the big spending. I'm not just going to call it the spending, but Joe Biden's big bill that's going to have climate change things in it and child care is staying in it. Some good developments happened on a special Sunday meeting yesterday. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Minnesota Reformer has an interesting article about how the Minneapolis police basically dropped the ball on 8 out of 10 gun crimes in Minneapolis. That's kind of an interesting story. I want to talk about the possibility of the elections in 2022. I want to talk about what is the best things to have happen before that. I want to talk about something called TAAS, T-A-A-S. It stands for Transportation as a Service. Have you heard anything about that, Brett?
I have not, no.
Yeah, very few people have. And I kind of tripped over it over the weekend and started doing some research on it, and it's very, very interesting and a hopeful future type of thing is what it is. So we'll talk about that as well. One thing I do have – where is it here? I'm sorry. I'm kind of doing too many things at once here. Oh, yeah. Also, a weird thing about OAN, that weird, freaky right-wing news outlet, and they tried to sue Rachel Maddow, and they lost pretty badly. So that's an interesting thing. One more. Oh, man. I can't – where is my – here it is. Okay. But – here's something that I'd like to go through. These are thoughts that actually came from before January 6th. This is something that I wrote on New Year's Eve, actually, and going into New Year's Day. It was a weird time. We were talking about the possibility of January 6th happening. You know, Donald Trump was doing all this freaky stuff, and he wasn't being president. He wasn't taking care of the pandemic. He was firing and hiring people, even though he only had 2 weeks left or 3 weeks left. It was a very tumultuous time. It was frustrating because of the DFL not being able to door knock in 2020, and that really hurt in the election. And I talked to DFL Chair Ken Martin about that a few weeks ago, and he said that he realizes that that decision did hurt us in the election. He doesn't regret making it because it would have killed him if anybody got hurt or died because of COVID during door knocking. So he doesn't regret making the decision, but he does say, yeah, it hurt us. And we really should have swept things up the same way we did in 2018. I believe we're going to in 2022. But 2020 was very difficult for the DFL. But I myself, even though the DFL did a great job and made new discoveries in a lot of ways because of the pandemic, new discoveries in voter outreach. One thing that Ken reported was that the DFL reached more voters than they ever had. And he was feeling really good about that. So finding alternative ways to reach out to voters, but still door knocking is the bread and butter of running a campaign for especially at the level of the Minnesota State House or State Senate. And we were not able to do that because of the pandemic. So I wrote something that I think that you'll find interesting. So I'm going to read that. It's actually on my blog at toddmickelson.com. It's entitled A Satellite View, and that's also what this piece is called. This is kind of a manifesto for the DFL that I've sent to a few DFL people, and they're finding it interesting and informative and helpful. So here it is. Here on the ground, change happens fast. Everything seems to be in a rush. Problems feel frequent and urgent. It's loud and anxiety runs high. But from the satellite view, the Earth looks the same as it did thousands of years ago, like a beautiful, serene place upon which to exist. When we're operating a political party on the ground, we often find ourselves reacting to the most recent, immediate issues. We forget about what were the most immediate and important issues just weeks earlier. Instead of learning from the past, we repeat mistakes. I would argue that although the current Minnesota Republican Party consists of the most inept and ignorant elected officials in our state's history, they're still better than the DFL at being patient enough to enact slow change as though they're planning from a satellite view instead of from a panicked ground level. The vast majority of people in Minnesota and the country are progressive in their thinking. When progressive issues are brought to a vote, the people vote in favor for it. In 2012, the issue of gay marriage was forced on Minnesota voters, ironically not by progressives, but by conservatives. Conservatives misjudged the will of the people and forced a vote to make gay marriage permanently illegal by trying to pass it as an amendment to the state constitution. The people voted overwhelmingly against that amendment. Progressives took that reaction and began working to legalize gay marriage. But if it had been up to the progressives, gay marriage may have been stalled in our state even longer. Minnesota progressives were afraid to talk about legalizing gay marriage in the legislature back in those days until the issue was forced by overconfident conservatives. Why? Why did progressives not lead that? Requiring background checks to buy guns polls no lower than 81% in rural Minnesota, up to 88% in the metro area. So why has the legislature not acted on this popular measure? And why are DFL legislators and candidates afraid to bring it up? Part of the reason panic on the ground has been the pandemic. Understandably, COVID relief measures have necessitated the reprioritizing of many legislative issues, but the pandemic has also put a microscope on one of the top issues the DFL has been trying to work on for a decade, statewide reliable internet access. Lack of broadband access has made it difficult, if not impossible, for thousands of children statewide to continue their education while schools have been closed. Mostly last year in 2020. Why was this not a top DFL talking point during the 2020 election? The Minnesota GOP has been fighting against expanding broadband for over 6 years. Governor Mark Dayton initiated the Governor's Task Force on Broadband in 2011. In 2014, a task force study recommended a budget of $100 million to expand of Minnesota. Everyone considered it a no-brainer, but by 2015, the Minnesota GOP took control at the State House, and amazingly, their budget proposal included $0 for broadcast expansion. This elicited so much outrage in greater Minnesota that the GOP reluctantly agreed to include $10 million for it, but that's only one-tenth of what was needed. So we're talking now 10 years ago. We've been working on this for 10 years, and we still don't have it. The result is that Minnesota is still in a dire need of broadband access. Thousands of kids are struggling and falling behind in school. Entrepreneurs and people being asked to work remotely can only be successful if they're fortunate enough to have good internet access. Creating a system of winners and losers, in particular rural Minnesota, will continue to lose people and economic opportunities until this problem is adequately addressed. This issue alone could win elections in rural Minnesota for the DFL. Why, then, is the Minnesota GOP winning so many elections in rural Minnesota? Because the DFL is failing to message in a way that convinces outstate Minnesotans the DFL is on their side, and the Min GOP is not. The DFL is not delivering clear and coordinated message to Minnesotans that the DFL's policy and intentions are what the vast majority of Minnesotans want. Further, the DFL is not clearly pointing out that the Minnesota GOP is working against the wishes of the vast majority of Minnesotans. The first step in solving a problem is recognizing there is a problem and identifying what that problem is. So I've just done that. Now it's time to move forward. We should not be shying away from bold initiatives. FDR put forth arguably the boldest policies in our country's history, and he was reelected 3 times. Those bold policies remain untouchable 80 years later. No one would dare try to do it away with Social Security. A modern-day example is the representative from the never-before-blue Orange County in California. In 2018, Katie Porter became the first Democrat to ever win that House seat. She has since become nationally known as a valiant progressive in Congress and still won re-election in her strong red district with an even larger margin of 53.5% of the vote in 2020. There's an example of untouchable, bold, progressive initiative in recent Minnesota history as well. The fourth-tier tax was implemented here 8 years ago. Of course, the Minnesota GOP fought against it at the time, but they don't talk about it anymore. They know it helped turn their $6 billion deficit into a $2.6 billion surplus in about a year. Within the revenues of the fourth-tier tax, or without the revenues of the fourth-tier tax, creates the legislature without the revenues the fourth-tier tax creates, the legislature would not be able to balance the state budget. It was a bold initiative to put in place at the time, but it works for Minnesota too well for the Republicans to argue against it. Since the policies the DFL wants to pass are in line with the vast majority of Minnesotans, why would we not talk more about them, fight for them, and pass them into law? Do we think we'll lose the next election by pleasing the overwhelming majority of voters? When the whole state of Minnesota, as opposed to individual districts, votes on something, they vote progressive. This is why the Minnesota GOP has not won a statewide election since 2006. Let's spread that success down to state, House, and Senate elections. Let's allow lessons from the past to inform us on how to move forward. And let's coordinate our messaging so it can fully break through to the voters. That's only part of it. It's pretty long. I'm not going to read it all right now. But these are ideas that you've heard me talk about when I have been on this radio station before, sitting in for Matt usually. And I think that we should not forget about these things. I think DFL candidates need to remember these things and talk about these things. Just because they happened a few years ago doesn't mean they should be forgotten. We need to learn from them when we're moving forward. So this is kind of my manifesto for the Democratic Party in Minnesota. It goes on with more details about specific items. Maybe we'll get to that later on. But why don't we take a break now and change the pace a little bit when we come back here on the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. If you'd like to call in, it's 952-946-6205. This is me on guitar, and I think, Brett, you're playing synthesizer, I think, on this one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Some Canadian music for you. On AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. We were just talking about being bold in politics and that the DFL should be more bold. And today is a sad reminder of somebody who did that. Paul Wellstone, 19 years ago today, died in a plane crash along with his wife and daughter. And Brad from Robbinsdale is calling in. He would like to talk about the Wellstone anniversary. Hello, Brad.
Okay, well, I mean, this is the 19th anniversary of the death of Paul Wellstone, his wife Sheila and daughter Marcia. And also, people forget, you know, the other campaign workers, Will McLaughlin, Tom Lupik, Mary McAvoy, and the two pilots, Richard Conray and Michael Guess. And I hope I did the names correctly here, yeah. But... again, it was a sad day for Minnesota, and I'm sure all their families.
Yeah, thanks so much for commemorating all of the people who were on the plane. You're right. That's not done enough. We usually just talk about Paul Wellstone himself. Oftentimes, people don't even talk about his wife and daughter, much less the other people that died in that sad plane crash that day. It was. Absolutely shocking and horrible for living in Minnesota at the time. He's still a huge hero to Minnesotans of both sides of the aisle. He was respected by Republicans, even though they disagreed with pretty much everything he had to say. But the reason he was respected was because he wasn't afraid to say what he believed in, and people really respect that. Do you remember the back the day, like when you first heard about it, Brad?
Yes, I was actually in an office up at St. Cloud State, and I heard someone, a woman down the hall, just burst into tears weeping, and I just had a sense of what it was. There was a radio announcement and the like, but it was a sad time, and I mean, I did some volunteer work at their office, and so I may have crossed paths with some of the other campaign workers. And Paul Wellstone was extremely accessible.
Yes,
to people.
Definitely, he was very engaging. He really listened to you when you spoke to him, no matter who you were. He was an incredible force. Had so much energy too, he'll live forever in Minnesota. I ran for office back in 2012 and 2014, and we went through candidate training, and it's actually called Wellstone training. And we talked a lot about Paul Wellstone in how to deliver political messaging. That'll live on forever.
Too.
What's that?
I went through that as well.
Oh, did you?
First year.
Okay.
He was a pillar.
Yes, he definitely was. He's the one who coined the phrase, we all do better when we all do better. And there are a lot of people who use that phrase who don't even know where it came from. So it's a sad reminder. I know so many people who actually worked with him back in – I didn't know him myself, but I know a lot of people who worked closely with him, and this day is always – in Minnesota, it's a really big day, always remembered by everybody. So thanks a lot for calling in, Brad, and thanks so much for reading all of the names of all of the people. So also talking about bold measures and elections, actually. I have talked about, even last week on this show, about how one of the we need to pass these popular measures that Joe Biden has in the Build Back Better bill. We need to get it passed before the 2022 elections so that people start to feel the results of it. And then the Democrats win much more widely than they will otherwise. And we do need to still turn out and vote, but we also need to, pass the voting legislation so that the Republicans can't just turn this into an absolute oligarchy, authoritarianism dictatorship and just throw out the election results. But I really see that coming. I Some other interesting news in that is that Kyrsten Sinema, five veterans on her advisory council abruptly quit, and they wrote a letter to her. And in that letter, they wrote, "You have become one of the principal obstacles to progress, answering to big donors rather than your own people. We shouldn't have to buy representation from you." So she's getting a lot of pressure, and I don't think she seems very strong. I don't know. Brett, I'm interested to see what a lot of people think about her. I kind of feel like she doesn't care about getting reelected. I kind of feel like she's just gotten in this as a complete grift, and she, you know, because if you sit in the Senate for a few years, you're going to become a millionaire. So that I think that's her only motivation. Do you see it any?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the motivation is that, yeah, you get that Senate career. All of a sudden you go work for Wall Street, whoever you want, and you can make a boatload of money. And she's well on her way to doing that. That's for sure.
Yeah. And so that's my only kind of thing that makes me nervous is that she doesn't care about any of this pressure. She doesn't care about anything other than getting money. And therefore, she's going to do what the pharmaceutical companies that are giving her millions of dollars, she's going to do what they want instead of what the people of the United States want. But there's it's good to hear that there's that much pressure going on. I mean, even from the inside of her infrastructure, it's falling apart. So hopefully, at least I'm really feeling strong that both she and Joe Manchin will decide to make adjustments to the filibuster in order to push the voting rights bill through. I don't know that they will do that for the other bills, but the other bills we can put through reconciliation, so we don't need to change the filibuster ruling. And there was this was in the Star Tribune. I believe the Associated Press actually wrote this, though. In Washington, pivotal Democratic Senator Joe Manchin appears to be on board with White House proposals for new taxes on billionaires and certain corporations to help pay for President Joe Biden's scaled-back social services and climate change package. Joe Biden said just today that he feels very positive about reaching an agreement on his big domestic policy bill, aiming for votes in Congress as soon as this week. That's far from certain, but the president goes on to say that is his hope. And so to me, that's great news. I mean, that's what happens in negotiations. I think that, some of this can be made up after we win more seats in 2022. But of course, you know, this whole plan is a little delicate, but I really think that it's probable that it will happen. We'll get the voting rights bill passed fairly soon, but certainly in time for the 2022 election. I think that Manchin and Sinema will go ahead with agreeing to do some filibuster adjustments in order to get that passed, and then we get right now they're talking about passing this Build Back Better bill. It was supposed to be $3.5 trillion over 10 years. That's the thing that the Republicans always leave out. $3.5 trillion worth of spending over the next 10 years. So Joe Manchin is saying, I want to cut it down to 1.5. Right now, I believe they're sitting at about $2 trillion, and they're thinking about cutting the time down then to 5 years, which actually would mean more spending in those 5 years than originally would have been in the 10-year-long plan. So I think that's fine. And then we get it passed. We get Manchin and Sinema to agree to it. We get 50 votes in the Senate. The vice president comes in and breaks the tie. It gets made into law. Parts of it start to get implemented. And by the time we get to the 2022 election, the Democrats get more seats in both the House but also in the Senate, so that we don't have to do this silly fight with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema every 10 minutes. And so then we'll have more power, because right now we can't – it's almost like we're already in an authoritarianism government because we can't get anything done because it's just absolutely sitting still. But except for this new news, that it looks like things are moving forward. After 2022, we can then restore the parts that are missing from the Build Back Better bill, including the time, you know, bring it back up to maybe even more. Bernie Sanders' original proposal was $6 trillion, so it's already been cut down to $3.5 trillion. And so that's my delicate plan that I feel very optimistic about happening in the United States. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk more about some positive things. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. If you'd like to call in, the number is 952-946-6205. We'll be right back. Can I get some nasty bass? You heard him, Brett. Bring in the bass.
Yeah, I can always bring the bass in.
Nasty. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Sorry, I got pulled in by watching Brett play the bass there. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. Brett's on the board. And talking a little bit more about the taxes, the people are calling it the wealth tax. You can call it the wealth tax if you want. But Republicans fail to finish the sentence when they're talking about these taxes. They say that, you know, Biden wants to raise your taxes. Well, unless you make more than $400,000 a year, he's not going to raise your taxes. And the fourth tier tax in Minnesota, it's, I think, really interesting in that the way it works is you're taxed a certain amount at different income levels. So when you get to making something like $153,000 a year, the fourth tier taxation kicks in and raises your taxes another, I believe, 1.4%. Maybe it's 1.6%. Only on the money that's more that you make that's more than $153,000. You don't get taxed a single penny more on anything below $153,000. And just by raising the tax on people who make more than $153,000 and only on the money above that amount and only raising it 1.4 or 6% changed a $6 billion deficit into a $1.2 billion surplus. That's how these taxes on really wealthy people go. Somebody pointed out on Twitter, to any billionaires wondering about the new wealth tax, taxes are just like the philanthropy you already do, except you don't get your name on a building, you don't choose what it's spent on. It's not optional, and your nephew can't be on the board. Also, I always think about how corporations, they spend so much money lobbying to try and keep taxes down that if they contributed that same amount of money in taxes, it would help everybody. And these are some nuances. And another thing is Republicans don't want tax levels to be lowered because, like, for instance, in Minnesota, we've said, okay, yeah, we'll lower the corporate tax to 25%, but we'll also get rid of all the loopholes. And then the Republicans are like, no, leave it at 39%. Because number one, they want to argue about it. They want to keep talking about how much of a problem it is. They want to keep talking about how the Democrats support higher taxation. And they realize that if they are forced to pay 25%, it's going to raise their taxes because with the loopholes, there are a lot of corporations who pay $0 in taxes. And getting rid of the loopholes will not allow that anymore. We got a couple of calls on the line. Robert from Columbia Heights is talking about the 50-50 split in the Senate.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a thumbs up to the last thing you just said. Corporate flat tax, no deductions. That would be great. Also, to split the 50-50 Senate logjam in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia should be made a state. And I could think of a few more.
Yep.
Maybe it's time for Puerto Rico to either fish or cut bait, either decide to become a state, or we let them go free and become a standalone nation.
Yep, I completely agree with you. I think they there was a lot of talk about that last spring or last winter, and Puerto Rico. I heard a very interesting thing where a lot of people do want to become an independent country. And a lot of people want to become a United State. And if they had a vote, it would probably be very interesting. And I completely agree with you. Thanks so much for making that point, because that would take care of a lot of problems in the Senate. And it would be great to not have, 100 so that we, have that magic number of 50. So thanks for calling in. Gary is on the line. He would like to say more about Wellstone and JFK speeches.
Yeah, when I was in my early teens and a week before the 60 election, I heard Kennedy down at the Armory. I was outside, so I didn't see him. His voice was so inspiring. The only thing I remember him saying was, this can't happen to Minnesota, put him over. I need every vote. If Minnesota goes, the nation goes, and Minnesota put him over. Anyways, Humphrey got beat by him in a couple of Wisconsin primary, and West Virginia was a positive state. That was big stuff back then, and yeah. Kennedy won there. And then Humphrey fought like heck for him. And so, both those guys are friends of labor, working people, and Humphrey had more to do with civil rights probably than anybody in the country, beginning to push it, in the 48th convention, speaking of that. But I was going to say, Wellstone. Kennedy was awesome, but Wellstone, nobody talked with such passion. Our movements and stuff I ever saw, he was the greatest speaker I ever seen. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Those are great great things that we need to remember more of. I saw a documentary about the primaries in 1960. And, of course, Minnesotans love Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey is the one who actually put the DFL together. There was the Democratic Party, the Farmer Party, and the Labor Party. And he suggested, I believe it was 1947 or 8, to put the three parties together put our forces together so that we're more powerful. So he was quite a crusader. The contrast between he and Kennedy was basically – it was like John F. Kennedy was like a rock star. I mean, when he came into the room, it just was electric. Even just in this old black and white footage, you could just see people's faces light up when he walked in the room. And, there was some – people talked a lot about this at the time. Some of his people that worked for him tried to get him to wear a hat because hat companies were losing money because they weren't selling as many hats, and they blamed it on Kennedy not wearing a hat. So they were always trying to get Kennedy to wear a hat, and Hubert Humphrey. It just looked like Hubert Humphrey was from the 1950s, and John F. Kennedy was from the 1960s, and a lot of the ideas, of course, were exactly the same. But both guys were, crusaders for a lot of the same things. And but Kennedy was just this huge force. And watching this documentary, it was just like, yeah, I could see why this happened, because, there just wasn't that excitement for Hubert Humphrey. It really looked like he was still in the 1950s and John F. Kennedy was in the future, a lot of people are remembering the Wellstone legacy. Dave from Minneapolis, thanks for calling in.
Hey, three things. One, I'm always excited when you substitute for Matt. You are so full of history and knowledge. I always learn a lot when you're on the air. So
oh, thank you.
First of all, thank you for taking the time to be on that show.
When you said you're so full of, I was a little scared of what you were going to say.
No, it's like, God, it's just, I wish you would write a book about all this stuff. It's just, you've got a lot of knowledge, great history. You got a good history, historic mind, and you know what's going on. So,
thank you very much.
Number two, Paul Wellstone. I helped with his campaign, when he first went against Boswitz and then against him again. But if you remember when he first ran, that was back in the day when what do you call that, when they were, Congress was doing this term limits thing. And Ronald Stone, at that time in 19, was it 92 or something?
Yeah, it was 92.
90,
yep.
1992. Okay, 1992.
Yep.
I remember he said, and he made this as part of a commitment on his campaign, he said, I will only run for Senate for two terms.
Yep.
I will be a two-term guy. And then he finished his, well, got through his, you know, halfway through or two-thirds through his second term, and he changed his mind.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting how people always say politicians lie. Well, I don't know what you call that, what Paul did, but he changed his mind. He never said, nobody, I don't know if anybody even asked him about that, but I always wondered, hey, what's going on, Paul? You said you ran on a campaign and said you're only going to do two terms. Not that I wanted him at two terms. I wanted him to go till he, you know, no longer wanted to be in the Senate.
The other
thing is,
go ahead.
Do you remember when he ran? Well, he didn't run, but he did the Kennedy campaign thing where he did all the same stuff as Robert F. Kennedy did when Kennedy was doing his war on poverty thing. Paul did a very similar thing. Went to all the same spots. Of course, everything was worse than it was back compared to Robert F. Kennedy. In fact, had Paul been able to do many of his stuff, we probably wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today, because now you got these people, the far right, who've been treated very poorly by our government, and they're totally anti-government. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. That's the same old thing where the Republicans, they tell you that government sucks, but they still want to run the government. Paul Wellstone was running in 1992, we were in a recession because it was immediately after the mess of Reagan and Reaganomics.
And
kind of what happened, he was pressured to run again, and of course everyone wanted him to stay, so he decided, I'm going to stay. And I think he might have even known that was going to happen from the very beginning.
Oh, sure.
But that's also why a lot of people talk about term limits, and I disagree with having term limits just for that very reason, because once we get somebody that's really good in there, we want to keep them in there, you know. And if there's too much turnover, you lose the guys who even know where the bathrooms in the building are, and that's a big part of what's going on in the Republican Party right now, with starting with the Tea Party. They pulled in a bunch of people who don't know anything about what they need to be doing as elected officials. So, you know, they don't have, and that's part of why their party's falling apart. And even here in Minnesota, I mean, I've seen it by going down to the Capitol and talking to some of these elected people, and it's like, wow, you've not learned anything. And so they don't have anyone left who knows how to even just, you know, write a bill. So they can't do anything. But thanks a lot for your call. That was fun. That was a fun conversation. And our callers are making us remember some very interesting things today. We have really smart callers that call into this radio station. So I think it's about time to take a break, and then we'll come back and finish out the hour. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil. Brett is on the board and playing music. Good singing. I don't think I've heard you sing before.
I can get my voice very high when called upon.
All right, cool.
When I heard you're filling in, I got to work those vocals out.
All right. One more thing about Paul Wellstone, another memory about Paul Wellstone. He made a commercial that everyone really liked, and it was really funny for the time. Where he talked about that, you know, he was just a very grassroots guy. That was kind of his whole gimmick that he was doing in 1992. And he said, so I don't really have enough money to have a long enough ad. So he like ran through the picture. They were at his house, and he said, I grew up here. And he ran through the picture. And then he goes, and I worked here. And then he, you know, ran by another building. And then I blah, blah, blah. And he was like running through the frame, trying to get, you know, his whole background explained in, you know, 10 seconds. And it was really funny. I actually kind of copied it a little bit when I ran. I didn't do exactly the same thing, but it was a good idea. It was a very concise ad, and it was a good introduction to him. So I thought, you know, steal from the best. That's how you win, right? And also, our last caller was – he was very gracious to me. I was kind of embarrassed. I think my face turned red, did it not, Brett, when he was complimenting how smart I am? And so I really have him fooled. But he said it would be interesting if I did some writing, and I have. If you are interested, it's you can go to toddmickelson.com. I have a kind of a blog sort of set up there called A Satellite View, and it's spelled TODDMIKKELSON.com if you're interested in going. And also talking about that, we were finished that call talking about how there's so much incompetence in mostly the Republican Party. You can see in Washington, Democrats are getting all this stuff done. What are Republicans doing? Basically nothing. They're just trying to scramble toward, you know, made up scandal after made up crisis. You know, oh, the border, oh, mask mandate, oh, the vaccine mandate. You know, where's Joe? You know, all this, you know, that's all they're doing. And so it really is lopsided. And now, you know, we're trying to be talking about going into the 2022 elections, and Democrats are doing that. But Republicans are still complaining about 2020. Or I'm sorry, did I say 2022? We're supposed to be going into the 2022 elections, and Democrats are doing that, getting ready, their campaigns ready, getting candidates lined up. You know, I'm even working in the DFL to do some of that, looking for a candidate to run for the Senate in our district out where I live. And, you know, that's what the Democrats are doing. Republicans are yelling about all these made-up false crises, and they're hurting because of it. In Missouri, I'm sorry, I pronounced it wrong, Missouri.
I don't know if you'd pronounce that wrong, though,
exactly.
In some respects.
Exactly. The state of Missouri. They have an open Senate race, and that's a big deal. You know, the Republicans really have a good chance of losing the Senate way worse than they have already lost it. So in their open Senate race, they're featuring a crowded cast of conservative characters: the self-described farm girl, the auctioneer on a bus tour, a state attorney general suing China, and the guy who stood in his lawn and pointed an AR-15 at protesters. But the guy who's ahead, the guy who's, you know, beating everybody, is their former disgraced governor, Eric Greitens, I believe is how you pronounce his name. It might be Greitens. And, I mean, Greg Keller, he's a big Missouri political strategist for the Republicans. He said, heaven forbid Eric Greitens ever did get in the United States Senate. And he's currently the guy, Greg Keller, who is lamenting the fact that he helped get Josh Hawley in the Senate. So he's feeling bad about the people that he's putting in the Senate. And also in Pennsylvania, Sean Parnell, there's basically, you know, run-ins where his wife has called the police because of domestic abuse issues. And he's the main candidate. Of course, Trump is backing both these guys. So everybody's all excited about these guys. And
don't forget Herschel Walker in Georgia.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they just have a mess of their collection of candidates. So I'm excited about the 2022 elections. And we're going to keep our head down and move forward. That's the end of this hour, but I'm coming back in a few minutes. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll talk to you on the other side. I'm at home so near. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. On the Matt McNeil Show, Brett's working the board and producing the show today. Matt is supposed to be back tomorrow, correct, Brett?
Actually, he's coming back on Thursday.
Oh, okay.
So you're stuck with me tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
And so possibly Wednesday. Matt might be back Wednesday. We're still figuring it out.
Okay. All right. So tomorrow, Brett will be sitting in for Matt, and then we'll play it by ear after that. anyway, I think that he's publicly said, though, that he's doing well after he had hip replacement surgery.
Yeah, correct? He's doing good after that. Yeah, when you get any type of surgery, it'll take a while to recover. He's saying it's still, you know, it's a long, slow recovery, but he's doing well.
Yeah. He was posting and looking happy, and I don't know, maybe he was just really stoned, but.
Yeah, he admitted that could be the case with the pain meds they give you with that.
And then I saw he posted a he called it the Count Chocula sandwich, and I thought, he's probably still kind of high.
Wait, well, the Count Chocula sandwich? I got to look at what this is.
Yeah, he put a picture, had two pieces of like pumpkin bread or something, and then he put chocolate cereal in between two slices, and then he called it the Count Chocula sandwich.
Oh yeah, I think those pain meds.
Yeah, so he's on some strong meds at the moment. If you're remembering an hour ago, I was talking about I was reading the thing that I wrote on ToddMickelson.com blog, A Satellite View, and we were talking about moving forward, and I talk a lot on this whenever I'm on this station about the broadband thing that happened about 8 years ago here in Minnesota that the Republicans kind of tried to block. But solving a problem like broadband across all of Minnesota or the country actually is very much like something that was called the Rural Electrification Act of 1936. And it's a very fascinating thing. Actually, on AM 950, there was a show running when I had to drive down to – I actually played in my 70s cover band down at the Brown County Fair. So I was driving down there, and I'm driving in deep, deep, deep corn country, and where there's buildings, you know, every few miles, and otherwise it's just tons and tons of corn fields. And there was a really interesting I can't remember what the show was, but it was, you know, Saturday afternoon at like 3. Maybe Matt, if you know what the schedule is better, I don't have it memorized, but it was the whatever's on at 3 o'clock on AM 950 on Saturday.
That'd have been the Sam Cedar and the Ring of Fire guys, I'm guessing. It does sound like something they might have talked about.
Well, whatever show it was, they had a guest on who knew a lot about the FDR days, and he was talking about the Rural Electrification Act while I was driving, and I noticed that there were lines running all on every road I was on. You know, I mean, some of the roads I was on was dirt, and they still had just miles, millions of miles of wires running all over rural Minnesota. And it was interesting because I was behind this kind of scary looking pickup truck. It's the kind of thing where I hope we don't have to get out of our cars because these guys are going to beat me up kind of thing. And they turned off and were going into what looked like a little party. And there was a little band set up in this like farm and just a house with a barn and a silo, and they set up a little tent and they had a band. And I'm like, you know, these people are probably, you know, and of course I'm stereotyping, but, you know, they probably hate Joe Biden. They probably hate this, you know, Build Back Better thing. And there they are having wires bringing electricity all the way out to their extremely remote location. And that was brought by the most liberal legislation in the history of the United States, if not the world, when FDR basically built back better. You know, electricity was not out in rural Minnesota until 1936. Before that, it was candles and lanterns. You know, it was basically very similar to the 1800s up until 1936 in Minnesota, if you lived out on a farm or something like that. And it was just amazing, and it was a kind of an interesting experience to have listening to this very knowledgeable guy talking about all this, and then actually witnessing the results of the Rural Electrification Act of 1936. Another thing about family farms I mentioned earlier that the DFL, the F in DFL stands for farmer. It used to be the Farmer Party. The Minnesota Farmer Party merged with the Minnesota Democratic Party in 1947 because Democrats fought hard for farmers and workers in the state. And that's there was also the work the Labor Party, and so that's what the L is in DFL. While the Minnesota GOP pays a lot of lip service to supporting farmers, they're really only concerned with large corporate farms and the campaign money they supply. So this is, again, I'm talking about this satellite view and my ideas for how the DFL should be more bold in their messaging, especially to outstate Minnesota. For decades, family farmers have been cheated, bought, and edged by these huge agribusiness monopolies. And they've been lied to by politicians promising to strengthen antitrust enforcement. Enforcing anti-monopoly rules like those already existing in the Packers and Stockyard Act and strengthening country of origin labeling would be some good first steps in setting things back to right for small farms. Farmers' share of every retail food dollar has fallen from 50% in 1952 to 15% today. So we need to explore ways to help keep small farmers thriving and prosperous. Family farmers are the most knowledgeable and respectful custodians of the land and environment, and they should be rewarded for their good practices. They should also have first dibs in selling to their local community. And the DFL needs to fight harder for that. The Republicans aren't gonna. So, you know, we need to fight harder for small farmers, and then we need to let them know that we're doing that. That's another kind of criticism I have. The DFL does a lot of good things that everybody likes, but they don't realize why it's there. They don't realize why the electricity is out in their very, very remote farm. It was put there by the most progressive legislation in the history of the country. So wow, what timing. I know Gene from Blaine has been wanting to talk about rural electricity for days, and it just so happens she's calling in right when I'm talking about it. Gene, how are you doing?
Fine. I'm spying on you on my laptop, and you started talking about the REA. And my grandfather over in Wisconsin was in charge of the REA. I believe it was for the state of Wisconsin.
Mm.
And he ended up being a whistleblower because there was collusion going on with the suppliers of material.
Wow.
And he ended up having to go to Washington, D.C. and what would you say? He was interviewed. He was, you know, he discussed that. And
he probably testified at a committee hearing or something.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That would be the word I'm having.
Yeah.
I can't think of my words, but
that's huge.
My father actually had copies of memos and things, correspondence that had gone back and forth between him and other people about some of this. And he actually had those papers, and he donated them to the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Oh,
we
good.
We were able to go to Madison and look at some of these papers. And we never met him because my grandfather died. I think my dad was in the service after high school, so we never met him. So we knew nothing about this.
Wow.
And a couple of my siblings and I went down there. And we don't know enough about our grandfather because he changed his name. We thought he was from Germany. He really came from Poland. And we don't know his education background or whatever, but to read his memos and things, you could tell he was educated.
Yeah.
And he actually spent some time, and my grandmother lived in Hartford, Wisconsin, and he actually worked for Kissel Car Company. Actually worked there for a while.
Uh-huh.
Then he ended up buying into a bank in Hartford. And
wow,
I don't know.
You should write
an interesting life.
Yeah, you should write down just the small, you know, the part that you know about it. I love stories like this. I find this the most fascinating thing in my hobby of studying history. When somebody actually lived through something and they remember it, I just wish everybody would write all that stuff down. You should write that down and keep it.
Yeah.
Because I find that extremely interesting. I'm so glad you called, and because that's a really interesting story to add to the to those days. It's fascinating. Yeah, there's just corruption in corporations going on all the time. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just like today, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Things never change.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people wouldn't maybe know the word collusion, yeah. But right away our eyeballs were all bulging out. Look at this. So we were taking, with our phones, we were taking photos of the papers, and my dad had one sister, so we emailed our cousins and said, hey, here's a treasure trove.
Yeah.
Nothing to do. I think you can probably go online and read them.
Yeah.
But I haven't pursued that yet. So,
wow.
Yeah, you started talking about it right away. I thought, okay, Grandpa Becker, here you go.
Yeah, I'm so glad you called in. Thanks a lot. Wow. Incredible story there from Gene, from Blaine. Something popped in my head here's a really interesting thing that one of my uncles remembers. And of course my grandparents did. And you know how you're a kid and, you get treated like a kid. So you don't find out a lot of stories, like, especially, you know, seedy stories about your relatives and stuff, but they just think you're a dumb kid and so they're not going to tell you the story. And then the story kind of gets forgotten. My grandparents lived next door to each other in Howard Lake, Minnesota. It's about 35 or 40 miles to the west, right on Highway 12. And it's a small town. They were farm people, and it was pretty farmer out there. They also had in Howard Lake is the Wright County Fairgrounds. And, my mom was just a little girl. Like a baby, but her brother, I think he's something like at least five, maybe even like 7 years older than her. And so he remembers this clearly, that during the Second World War, they had, Nazi prisoners of war housed in the Wright County fairgrounds, right in Howard Lake, Minnesota. And that kind of freaked me out. And, you know, it's just things like that that get forgotten in history. And I find those things really interesting. Well, we went over time because it was so fun to talk to Gene. And so we're going to take a break and come back. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson. I'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil today, and Brett Johnson is on the board. That was actually the Beatles. That was not me.
I don't think we can pull that one off.
Yeah, yeah. The people would know, you know. I was going to talk about transportation as a service. Really interesting. Sometimes things go on and it's not on anyone's radar except for the people who are making it happen. I remember starting maybe 8 or so years ago, Heidi, my wife, and I started to notice these buildings going up in cities, and they look futuristic, you know, and they were starting to work on more affordable housing. Some of these, you know, mostly in larger cities than Minneapolis, but you know, you've seen where these people move into really small apartments, and they're very super efficient, and it's almost like looks like it would be in Japan or something like that. And so there's all this progress being made that's not really talked about on the news or anything like that. Well, transportation as a service is one of these things, but it's going on already in a few cities. Phoenix has, I think, 400 self-driving vehicles that you can order to drive you places. So it's one of the first places. There's some in California. There's a new program in Boston that's starting this, and it's all under the moniker of it's TAAS, TAS, and it stands for Travel as a Service. The reason that it's starting to ramp up now is because there's an electric vehicle crossover point. And this is what – when they were saying the crossover point, you know, they've been talking about it coming in the future. At some point, it's going to cross over so that an electric vehicle is less expensive to own than a motorized vehicle, less expensive to buy. They are way less expensive to maintain. And they've been – at first they said they were predicting probably 2026. Now it's down to 2022 because it's going so much faster than they thought. Last year, the Tesla Model 3 was one of the top-selling cars apparently, which I didn't know that. I got a Tesla last year, in last December, and I love it to death. The more I drive it, the more I love it. And it's basically – what's happening is when something becomes 90% less to use and maintain, that's the crossover point. And that's happening now because electric vehicle costs are coming down. And there's more of them, of course. So and so it's going to be that motorized vehicles are going to be more expensive to make, you know, constantly. But electric vehicles are coming down in price. So there's some numbers that are really interesting. A motorized vehicle, if you drive it 15 for 5 years and you drive it about 12,000 miles a year, which I think is kind of an average for people. So over a 5 years period of time, that car is going to cost you about $15,000 to run it and maintain it. Oil change, putting in gas. For 5 years going 12,000 miles a year in an electric vehicle, $1,600. Moving parts in a motorized vehicle, you know, all the gears and, you know, all the drive shaft and all this stuff, there's about 2,000 moving parts. And whereas in electric vehicles, there's more like 20, and that mostly just has to do with the actual wheels themselves. So maintenance, I mean, there's no transmission, so there's no transmission fluid, there's no oil, there's, you know, there's a little bit of lubrication for some of the moving parts, but there's no oil in an engine because it's an electric motor, and electric motors right now they're saying they can go, you know, at least 500,000 miles, as opposed to a motorized car. Now, you know, we had a Volvo wagon and got about 230,000 miles, and I felt like, wow, that's great, you know. So this is two times more than that. And really, they don't know yet because electric vehicles are relatively new enough that people haven't been putting, you know, probably more than 500,000 miles on them yet. So for all we know, electric motors could go a million miles. So it's really interesting that, and then also coupled up with technology, and Tesla's going really hard in on this just this year about self-driving vehicles. I could have got a feature. I didn't because it cost about $10,000 more. But I could have – a friend of mine has it, and we were just standing in a parking lot, and he said, watch this. And he pushed a button on his phone, and his car was on the other side of the parking lot, started up, drove, you know, didn't hit anything, drove right up to his feet with nobody in it. I don't have that feature, but you can get that feature in a Tesla right now. But it's much more advanced now. So basically, it's getting more expensive, of course, but this feature will also come down in price as time goes on. And it's interesting because with Tesla, you can add these things because it's basically like software. You know, I have software downloads. Every once in a while, they, you know, I'll just get a message saying, hey, there's a software update. You want to schedule it? And then it gives you the choice of 2 a.m. And you can choose a different time, but I just choose 2 a.m. And then when I wake it up in the morning, it says, hey, here's what happened last night. You got this now and this now and this now. So even if you have a 5-year-old Tesla, you're basically, it's keeping new because most of it is just this software. You know, I mean, they do add some physical features, but, you know, there's not – like this friend of mine, I think he got his about 4 years ago, and his and mine are exactly the same because, you know, he just keeps getting software updates. So he's just as new as I am, and with my – that I got less than a year ago. And so the self-drivingness, basically – starting now, actually, Tesla does have this, but it's really expensive, I think, where you can program it basically to, like, go pick up your kids at school just by itself. The car just leaves your house, goes, doesn't hit anything, picks your kids up, you know, and brings them home. There's what's going on, like in Phoenix, this, you know, kind of trial runs, is basically what's going to be going on is that you don't have to own a car. You can just call a car basically the same way you would order an Uber ride right now, and the car would come to you and take you where you want to go. That way you can – you just need a small car if you're just going to like go to work, or if you need to do something bigger, you can order a pickup truck, you know, but you don't have to own it, and you don't have to bug your friend who owns it, you know. So that's what's going on right now in the world. And you know how – I mean, Brett, you know how like iPhones, you know, touchscreen iPhone, smartphones, I guess, is what. So not just iPhones, but smartphones. Basically, the first ones were in – when would you guess is the first smartphone
that's available? Probably the mid or late 2000s, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Right around there.
Yeah, you're right. 2007. And – you know, now it seems like what was the world like before smartphones? I mean, most of my life was lived before smartphones, but it's like, you know, and you know how you tell stories about like something that happened when, you know, in the 90s or something, and you always have to remind people that, you know, we didn't have cell phones, so I was just out there by myself. I couldn't call anybody, you know? And, you know, I mean, 5 years from now, we might very well be living in this world where this travel as a service is the norm, and we're just used to it. And, you know, maybe 10 years, I mean, relatively soon, it could be like 10 years from now, you and I would be having this discussion. We'd say, remember when we used to have to drive and own our own cars? That was crazy, man. You know? So I just thought that was really interesting, and it is going on. And, I don't know why things like that aren't talked about more, But once it starts to get to be an economical thing, then it moves really fast.
That was just nuts what you said. 2022 is really going to be that year where, yeah, the electric vehicles are going to be less.
Yeah.
Wow. I missed the boat on that because I bought my car about 3 years ago, and I kind of regret it.
Yeah, I know. I know somebody who wanted to buy an electric car but couldn't because there's no charging station by her apartment building. So she just got a new car and you know, wanted it to be electric, but – so that just shows you we need to build our infrastructure for the future as well. Again, we went over time, so let's take a break and come back at AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil, and Brett's on the board, and we'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil. That was Brett on the very distorted bass. And I was playing drums on that one. So
that was a solid job then over there on the drums.
Yeah, you and me together would sound pretty tight.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mention this every once in a while. When taking in political news especially, you got to be careful because – we live in an age where all the news outlets are owned by corporations, and they're trying to make money. It's not like the Walter Cronkite days where it was a public service and networks would do news basically as a public service. They weren't I think they didn't even have commercials during the news back, like, even when I was a kid. And now, of course – you know, they gotta keep you tuned in. So if the news is good one day, then you're not incentivized to go watch the show. So they're constantly trying to make things sound crazy. And it really works on everybody's nerves. It's very unhealthy. So I always try to talk about, you know, be very careful when you're doing this. You know, right now we're spending so much time talking about the crazy people who are mad at mask mandates and vaccine mandates. They get way too much attention, you know, and like talking about, well, the police are going to walk off the force because of this vaccine mandate. You know, when they say 200 cops walked off of the Chicago force you know, there's how many it's it comes to be like maybe 3 or 4% of the police force. So they but they make it sound like, oh, my God, all of the police are going to walk off the job. It's a very, very small amount of people who are actually leaving their jobs instead of getting a vaccine. And by having the vaccine mandate, they have brought the vaccinated number of cops and frontline workers up by a lot. And, of course, that is more healthy. The vaccine doesn't work unless everybody gets it. That's why we no longer have polio. It's not because there was herd immunity for polio. It was because of a vaccine. And that's what we need to do here. So, you know, always remember when you're hearing these sensationalistic stories about – and they always find one or two people to interview. They don't ever interview the person who goes, oh, yeah, no, I got my vaccine last April and I'm fine. I'm not going to quit. No. I mean, they don't put those interviews on because they're boring. They only put the big sensational interviews on. So remember, that doofus that you're seeing is a very small percentage. That person does not represent whatever they are. They don't represent the cops. They don't represent the nurses. They're just one idiot who's a very small percentage. Another thing is that talking about this January 6th thing, everybody's very excited now because, you know, this new news came out. And, of course, everybody's saying, arrest them. Arrest them now. You know, put Bannon in jail. There's a really – I think a very thoughtful source and very knowledgeable source that I pay a lot of attention to because this guy reminds people kind of the same thing that I'm talking about right now. It's on Twitter. I follow him. It's at Palmer Report, and he's made a lot of predictions that have come true. He writes, the January 6th committee's criminal referral against Bannon appears to have scared Jeffrey Clark into testifying. Jeffrey Clark is the guy who was trying to push the Georgia legislature into not certifying the vote and then having another election. He was trying to convince the legislature to do that, and he was trying to get the then-acting attorney general to sign this letter. But he refused to sign the letter. But that's who this Jeffrey Clark is. He was subpoenaed to testify in front of the January 6th committee, and he did. He showed up. He's testifying. And likely because the criminal referral against Bannon went through. So the DOJ's arrest of low-level January 6th attackers appears to have scared a lot of the leaders into flipping. You know, the leaders of the January 6th, these two guys who talked to Rolling Stones magazine, you know, they said that they were told that they would get blanket pardons from Trump if they went ahead and planned this overthrowing of the United States country, which is what they, you know, what they were trying to do, they thought. So they are getting scared into turning. And he adds, even as pundits decry these approaches, they're clearly working. Pundits demanded Bannon be thrown into the Capitol jail cell. But a judge would have freed him within hours, and then no one would have been scared of the committee. The pundits' idea for a more aggressive approach would have been a disastrous failure. Pundits also demanded that the DOJ quickly arrest House Republicans on January 6th charges. But without inside cooperating witnesses, these charges would never have resulted in a conviction, and they would have gotten away with it. Another disastrous, aggressive idea from pundits. At some points, you realize most pundits are just yelling out stupid magic wand ideas so they can sound aggressive, knowing that the adults in charge would never actually do anything so stupid. Meaning the pundits can then look judicious by bashing the people in charge for not doing it. He goes on further to write, the kicker is that after the pundits spent all year floating ludicrous ideas and the DOJ and January 6th committee succeeded by doing things the smart, methodical way and anyway, these same pundits will now take credit for having pressured the DOJ and the committee into taking action. So these are things that you got to keep in mind. There are more and less degrees of this going on. I'm not saying that all pundits are this way. I'm not saying that they're all wrong. I'm not saying they're all sensationalists. There are a lot of really good ones. So pick those people. I think Nicole Wallace is great. I think Rachel Maddow is great. There are others as well. Another thing that is pointed out is that everybody's trying to talk about that Merrick Garland needs to call a special counsel. And a special counsel is for when the DOJ has a conflict of interest so that they can't investigate it themselves. So that's what a special counsel is used for. Bringing in a special counsel doesn't – it's not because the case is bigger or more important. It's because the DOJ – it would be a conflict of interest if they worked on it without hiring a special counsel. So if Merrick Garland does not appoint a special counsel, it doesn't mean he's failing. It means he knows what he's doing, and it means that he is still working with using the DOJ to do the proper way of handling these things. And I remind you again that back in the Watergate days, the United States Attorney General under Richard Nixon went to prison, but not for 3.5 years after. So people weren't even really paying attention to Watergate anymore when he went to prison. It was 1977. Everyone was listening to Kiss Alive 2. I think that came out in 78. They were listening to Kiss Rock and Roll Over. And they had forgotten about Watergate. And the attorney general went to prison. And it was maybe on like the second page of the newspaper, because it wasn't the big sensationalistic news anymore. But he did go to prison. So remember these things when you're feeling upset, like everything's falling apart around us. It's really not. Things I feel – well, and President Biden says this all the time. I totally agree with him in my feeling. I feel very optimistic. I feel more optimistic than I have – since I was naively optimistic when I was a kid. The Republican Party has finally gotten to the bottom of their barrel. They've been working on it for 40 years, and they finally got to the bottom. And now they're overplaying hand after hand, and they have crappy candidates, scandalous candidates. They have a bunch of horrible people as their candidates to run for the Senate and the House in 2022. They are not doing well, and we have a chance to do all these things that are positive that we're talking about. We have a chance to get all of this Build Back Better bill going and really seriously improving the world, including climate change. And what I talked about, the transportation as a service, think about how good that's going to be for climate change. And when things like that happen, it is disruptive. And some people lose their jobs, some people lose their companies, but the companies that are going to get downsized are oil companies that need to get downsized. Otherwise, the world's going to wipe us off. I've always called humans the acne of the earth. You know, the earth isn't going to die. It's going to grow up, and it's going to no longer be a teenager, and the acne is going to be gone, and the earth is going to be a better place.
I might have to use that analogy. I kind of like that one.
Yeah, it's a little graphic, but, you know, I don't know. I think I made that up when I was, like, in high school or something. Smart guy. Why? What a smart guy. I have everyone fooled in that regard. And not everyone. You don't think I'm that smart. So I know that's true. But anyway, well, it's time. This has been a really fun day. We got a lot of calls coming in. You can call too if you want to call 952-946-6205. We've had a lot of really interesting stories that people are telling. But it is time to take another break, and we'll come back and finish out the show. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. Brett's on the board. That was pretty, like, computerized music. There wasn't anything for us to play in that.
A little bit of auto-tune in there, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Here's some more interesting and good news. And I find it just this story is just only a part of it. Business applications in the United States have just absolutely soared They've been looking at I'm looking at a chart that's got, you know, squiggly line. It looks like from 2007 or 2006, it looks like maybe this starts, that it kind of was flat for, you know, like 10 years, looking like it was pretty much, you know, 70,000 was the top of the year, you know. It's constantly fluctuating throughout the year. And then in the highest level of business applications in the United States was – looks like about 90,000. And now in 2021, the highest – it peaked at 140,000. And right now it's still at about 100,000. It fluctuates throughout the year. There's different times of the year that's easier to start a business, usually right at the beginning of the year and right in the middle of the year, you know, after the second quarter. So the line kind of goes up and then down and then up and then down and then up and then down. But the highest it went up was, looks like, about 90,000 in 2020. And then in 2021, it went up to about 125,000 and then down and then up to about 142,000. And so the trend is really very remarkable. And I think a lot of it is because people – the pandemic – there's – of course, the pandemic is a horrible thing. But there are some things – it's almost like resetting things, almost like rebooting, kind of cleaning things up to a certain degree. There are a lot of people who've lost their jobs for some reason or another, and they're coming back with a better idea. So I know a woman who is working on something that she used to do more as a hobby, but she's taken it more seriously now. She got laid off because of the pandemic, only because of the pandemic. And it looks like her job maybe can come back now, but she's, you know, she's thinking that she might not go back to that job, that she might build her life around this thing that she's much more passionate about. And you also hear people – and by the way, the assistance that she got during the time she was laid off helped her. She actually, you know, had a lost her place where she lived as well, and had to move in with her mom for a while. And then now she was able to get into a really nice place, but she qualified for it, and so, you know, her place that she's living is nicer, and she's just, you know, kind of having now for the last couple of months, she's been having a great time. It was really hard to go through it, but now she's like building back better. And I think a lot of people are kind of doing that. Do you know of any stories like that? Any people that you know who are kind of like, yeah, I don't know that I'm going to go back to my old job?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, but I can't blame anybody who doesn't. I think that's often missed why people don't want to work anymore. Yeah. There's a lot of reasons.
Right.
They don't want to get COVID, might need childcare. There's a lot of
exactly.
People are going back.
And of course, the states that, you know, did what you just said, they're very red conservative states. They got rid of the $300 checks like in July, and people didn't go back to work. They still didn't go back to work. And of course, they also have the highest amount of COVID cases. So probably exactly like what you just said, Brett, people are like, well, I don't want to go back to work because I don't want to get COVID because – and nobody I know is vaccinated because everybody else who lives in this state are one of those people. And I don't want to go to work and get sick. And and so the philosophy of that, the $300, it was $300 a month, I think.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can't live on $300 a month very easily. And so. The Republicans saying, you know, oh, that $300 a month is what's making people not go back to work. Well, a lot of the states experimented with that, got rid of the $300 a month early. I think it's gone completely now. I think it ended at the end of September for the whole country, but these states ended it early, and their unemployment rates still rose. It wasn't – people were not going back to work. Now we're seeing in this data that people are actually applying for – to start a new business. So I think that's a pretty incredible thing. Another thing is it's going to wake up some of the greedy corporations who underpay and maybe don't have the best safety measures and things like that. You know, the regular people are starting to demand their rights that, you know, people like us, and I think most people who listen to this radio station agree are a right and not a privilege. You know, people are starting to see, I want to be safe and I want to get paid for my time. I don't want to work for you, have you make all the money, you underpay me to make sure that you, you know, stay rich and greedy. So, you know, there are some silver lining, I guess is what you would call it, in the whole pandemic mess. So many things to talk about, and I can't even think of anything more to talk about. Here's something that we can do. When I'm going to come on the show, I go through my Twitter. I have a pretty good lineup for information and news, mostly political. I only got on Twitter when I became a candidate. So my Twitter doesn't have, you know, people taking pictures of what they're eating that night and stuff. It's pretty much nothing but, you know, political kind of stuff. And sometimes I just go down it and there's tons of things to talk about, like the deterioration of the Trump and Kevin McCarthy relationship. And also when I was talking about these really bad candidates from before, there are some Republicans, the people who mostly who work in at the state level in the Republican parties, they're panicking. Because they're seeing what's going on and they're like, we cannot deal with this candidate. We can't keep this candidate as our senatorial candidate. You know, we got to pick some – we got to have somebody better. We can't go along with Trump, you know. So it's hard for me to call anybody who's still in the Republican Party a sensible person. But the sensible people who are trying to, you know, make the trains run on time and make things happen mostly at the state levels, they're panicking over this whole Trump thing because they know it's absolutely killing the Republican Party. So, you know, that's more interesting stuff. Also, the indictment of the Trump organization, pretty much the district attorney in Manhattan waited until after the primaries because he didn't want that to, you know, affect the primary election. So he basically waited until after the primary election to incriminate the Trump organization. Well, now we have an election coming up in about a week and a half. And so we'll see what happens right after that election in Trump world. So, yeah, maybe it'll be tumbling all down, come tumbling down. Well, that's it for me. Brett's going to be in here tomorrow at 4, from 4 to 6. So tune in to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I was Todd Mickelson. See you later.